Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and welcome to the first Michael Steele Podcast for 2020. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. You know how that goes. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, 2019 was a biatch. A year full of crazy, wrapped in a bunch of stupid, seasoned with a whole lot of WTF. And today, we're going to take a listen to some of my favorite moments from some of my favorite guests who joined me here on the podcast. They kind of encapsulated so much of what 2019 was about. So let's start with a conversation I had with Rick Wilson. Now, Rick is a Republican strategist and the author of the bestseller, Everything Trump Touches Dies. Yeah, that's the title of the book, folks. Now, we tried to diagnose what real Republicans are supposed to do in the era of Donald Trump. All the things that you and I have been in trenches and battles over for many, many years, most times going against Democrats, but sometimes going up against fellow Republicans to get it right.
Once in a while.
Right, you know? Are those ideals and those virtues and those values that defined modern day conservatism. And our goal and our hope coming out of the 2016 election would be, how do we now, you know, redo this, upgrade it, make it better for the 21st century and beyond, right?
Yep.
Then along comes Trump. And all of that's thrown out. So the question now becomes, what does a Republican, because the party thing is just kind of shot to hell at this point.
Right.
Yeah. What does a Republican do?
Who, yeah, small R Republican.
Small
even.
R, right. Small R Republican. Exactly. Very small R Republican. what do they do going forward in this environment? Next year's going to be brutal. My predictions standing right here now is the Senate is lost next year.
I think that's why Mitch McConnell has been so very nervous about another shutdown.
Yes.
I talked to one of the Senate pollsters who expressed to me during the middle of the shutdown, I said, when did you want this to end? He said, I wanted this to end never, ever to start at all.
Right.
But we are in deep shit right now. We are in deep trouble.
Yep.
And they're blaming us and they're blaming Trump. And we're going to take the damage, and he'll just drift away from this.
Right.
And he says, you've got purple state senators up for re-election. You know, 2020 is our bad year on the cycle.
I know.
We only had 8 Republicans up who were vulnerable this time. Next time we have 23 at minimum.
And right
and
now,
maybe with retirements, 25.
Yeah. And right now, 6 of them are, from what I'm hearing through the various committee pipelines, are in real, are pretty much toast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just...
I don't know how much more winning you want. I think I've had enough winning right now.
Yeah, I'm done with the winning. I get it. Can we lose? Can we lose? Can we just lose some? That'll be fine for me right now, because the winning is kicking my ass. Okay?
The winning, I am beat down by all this winning.
So I don't know what a small R Republican does. You know, I hate to lose, you know, guys like Schmidt and Scarborough. I hate to lose, you know, folks like S.C. Cupp and others who, represent such a broad spectrum of modern day conservatism. And yet it's been Trumpified to the point that what was once of real value to us is unrecognizable. So I don't know what you do. I mean, I got asked recently, what does the party look like a year from now? I'm like, grits? I don't know.
Honestly, I got nothing on that front at this point because, you know, and I've got Republicans right now who are saying things like, well, you know, as bad as this whole emergency declaration is, as unconstitutional as it is, well, you know, Green New Deal. What? I mean, they're conflating, you know, a girl who's who's a brand new congressperson and who's, you know, barely out of college with, oh, let's shred the Constitution because we're afraid of her Twitter feed.
Right.
Let's let Donald Trump run rampant for 4 more years because of some 28-year-old congresswoman's Twitter feed. I mean, this to me strikes me as a bad set of trade-offs. You know, do you want to keep a party that has a long and honorable tradition, or do you want to just throw it all to the wind and say, screw it, you know, I'd rather own the libs than have a functioning constitution?
Yeah, that's pretty much how I assess where they are right now. I don't think – I called it the most pathetic form of – fecklessness. I mean, they just.
Oh, it is.
It is. I mean, it's one thing to be feckless. It's another just to be pathetic at that, even that. And right now, I'm watching and listening to, you know, guys like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell, you know, say, I stand with the president. If he wants to violate the Constitution for political purposes and his own self-aggrandizement and self-appeasement, I'm with him. And that's what
MAGA
I hear.
MAGA all the way.
MAGA all the way.
Yeah, they I mean, and you know, look, this has been a subject I know you struggle with and I certainly struggle with in the last couple of years. This slow realization that a lot of the stuff we really thought that the party cared about and we cared about, you know, balanced budgets, addressing the debt and the deficit, you know, limited government, not having an all-powerful executive. A lot of those things we used to say we cared about. Apparently, a lot of our compatriots actually never did.
Right.
Because you know, we've got a trillion dollar debt now. And the reaction in Washington has been a collective shrug. I mean, I remember going on shows the entire length of the Obama administration, pulling what little hair I have left out, saying, this debt and deficit are going to absolutely kill us. This is a disaster. This is an existential threat to our country. And now it's like the shoulder shrug, like, oh, well, whatevs.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in a situation where everything that we ran on for decades has been proven to be either a lie or disposable.
And yeah,
it is frightening and it's frightening and horrible. And you know, the problem with the things like today of Trump suddenly taking all this additional executive power is when a Democrat takes office, they're not going to say, oh, well, Trump was wrong. He went too far. They're going to say, here's a new toolbox I have. And if Trump could do it and get away with it, I'm going to do it too. And I think we're in a real, really bad spot as a country because of what Trump has done and the abuse of this particular constitutional restriction is going to be one we regret and regret and regret and regret.
That's Republican strategist Rick Wilson on how Republicans will come to regret the expansion of executive power. And you know they will because, well, they're Republicans. Now, Joy Reid, my colleague and friend over at MSNBC, came on the show to talk about her new book, The Man Who Sold America, Trump and the Unraveling of the American Story. Needless to say, we got into congressional subpoenas and the dangers of mindlessly following Donald Trump. And, well, you can pretty much tell where that conversation went. So the Justice Department sent Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a letter from the Deputy Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, that said that both Bill Barr, the Attorney General, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, didn't commit a crime. When they defied the congressional subpoenas that were seeking information about the 2020 census. So, therefore, the department would not bring the congressional contempt citations before a grand jury or take any other action to prosecute the attorney general or the secretary. So, y'all out there, if y'all get a subpoena for somebody,
Y'all don't have to show. It's not a crime if you don't show up, if you don't honor the subpoena. Oh, by the way, when they come for your ass, you may have some splaining to do. But just so you know, all y'all folks out there, just be aware that the rules are different for Wilbur Ross and Bill Barr.
And William Barr, between him and Speaker McConnell, I think they might be the two most dangerous men in America. Because, you know, for Mitch McConnell, there is no law, there is no morality, there is no patriotism. There's just give us the courts. They just want the court. They don't care who's in the White House to give it to them. That's all he cares about is power. There's only power. That's it. Power.
Well, it'll be his legacy. His legacy will be, I got us a 6-3 court. Or
that's it.
Potentially a 7-2 court.
Yep, that's all he cares about. And he cares about power. For William Barr, there is no law. There is just Donald Trump. When I see William Barr, all I think of is two words, Hail Hydra. If you watch those comic books, and I open the book likening Trump to a comic book villain, if you want to add to the Marvel, add Marvel Universe in, because of course Batman and Joker are DC Comics universe.
Right.
But if you want to toddle on over to the Marvel Universe, think about the people who said Hail Hydra in those comics. There's no law. There's no right or wrong. There's no religion. Everything is Trump. Trump is everything. He is God. He is king. He is master. Nothing matters but him. And they don't feel that they have to abide by any law that would hurt him. They think they can flout any law that would touch him. All William Barr exists to do is to protect Donald Trump and to amass more power in the process. This is not a man who cares about you, me, the law, the Constitution. Hail Hydra. That is who William Barr is. And that is terrifying to me as somebody who thinks this is supposed to be a democracy. And he is so quietly dangerous because I think Donald Trump could commit an open felony and he would find a way to excuse it and to let him go.
That's my friend Joy Reid talking about a frightening vision of the possible future under Donald Trump. And one of the reasons, among many, that made 2019 a great year for our podcast was that I had the opportunity to talk with folks like actress, producer, author, and humanitarian Alyssa Milano from Who's the Boss, Melrose Place, Charmed, and so much more. Now, she's no conservative. There's no doubt about that. But we had a great conversation about the efforts she's made to cross the political aisle that even landed her spending time with Senator Ted Cruz. Check this out. I remember when the headline broke on my phone that you had met with Ted Cruz and on the issue of guns. And I chuckled to myself. I was like, okay, I need to be a fly right now on that wall.
First of all, to be a fly on that, I would want to be a fly on that wall because, first of all, that day started very, very early. I was on the Hill with Peter Morley, who's a patient advocate who fights for health care for other patients who don't have the strength to go fight themselves.
Right.
So I had been lobbying with Peter Morley and Hassan Ahmad, who is a immigration attorney. And we had been on the Hill for, we did like 15 meetings one day, and then the Ted Cruz meeting was the following day, and I had, in the morning I had 5 meetings, and then I had a panel on post-pregnancy mortality, and postpartum depression, and women's health, and then straight from that, I went to the Ted Cruz meeting. So I literally
talk about postpartum.
Oh my gosh, Michael! I woke up with a panic attack. I'm very honest about the fact that I have anxiety and I have these panic attacks, right?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people have them,
right? Right.
And I'm just real open about mine. So I wake up and I feel like I'm dying. Okay, I'm looking at the ceiling, going, "What have I done?" And I get dressed.
A lot of Republicans have said that over the years, too.
Yes, yeah, so. I get dressed, and I see Congressman Kennedy in Dunkin' Donuts that morning on the Hill, and he looks at me, and he's like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, no, I'm having a panic attack. He's like, why? I said, why? Because I'm meeting with Ted Cruz today. And he, not even like showing me any compassion at all. He goes, yeah, well, good luck with that.
Right, right.
And he like took a sip of his coffee and left. And I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Right? So I fight through. I fight through with, and anyone with anxiety could say, like, can tell you the most important thing is like you have to be functional. You have to fight through it. And so I fight through it, and I get to Ted Cruz's office, which is so intimidating, right? And his aides that were working in the office were very professional, but also not the warmest people, right? They know that
right.
That I hold the key to whatever.
Right. And, right, exactly.
You know, I drink a Diet Dr. Pepper. I've never had one of those in my life. But that's what they had. They were like, would you like a water or a Diet Dr.
I'll
Pepper? And I was like, uh-huh. Like, they could have literally offered me, I don't know what. I would have been like, yep, that's what I need.
I'll take that. Me too.
Then all of a sudden, Fred Gutenberg walks in. And for those that don't know, Fred lost his amazing 14-year-old daughter, Jamie, in the Parkland shooting. And he's been such a strong voice. You know, if I have the panic attack, so, you know, fight or flight, right?
Right.
Like, I get the flight, which is I'm panicking and I need to leave, and Fred gets the fight. And he's been in this fight since that horrible, horrible day. And he's just a force. And I looked at him, and I felt immediately better, obviously, because I was like, oh, thank God. And I had Ben Jackson with me, who started NORA with me. And which is basically a GVP org that is trying to diminish the power of the gun lobby in Washington.
Create some balance in the place.
let's figure this out.
Right.
Because a lot of people are dying, 40,000 people a year from gun violence. So so we're all there, and you know, and then they come out to get us, and we walk into Senator Cruz's office. And he's got like a whole film studio set up. And he looks at me almost condescendingly, but I might be projecting, mind you.
Right.
And he says, you said you wanted to live stream this. Is that okay? And I thought, oh, here we go. I said, yep, that sure is. It's sure, it's okay.
It's like the Dr. Pepper. Yeah, I'll take two.
Yeah, exactly. And can I have another Dr. Pepper?
Exactly.
So we sit down, and I'm telling you, Michael, I had prepared. I have a professor in constitutional law that I seek advice from quite often. I have access to survivors, to amazing GVP orgs, to Gabby Gifford. I mean, I had prepared so solidly for this meeting. And when face-to-face with him, not that all of it left me like I was... I couldn't find what I was looking for. All of it left me because I was sitting and I was face to face with a human being.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason why I needed to take this meeting. Because here's what I think we do. We look at those from the other side and we villainize them. And we create a narrative that excludes the human aspect of who these people are. Now, sometimes... you can look at the other side, whether you're Republican or a Democrat, and you could disagree with the system that has been created.
Right.
But at the end of the day, there are people from the other side, and they have wives and children and families that love them. And basically, when I was sitting face to face with Ted Cruz, for some reason, humanity took over. And I wanted to sort of look him in the eye and talk to him as a human being, as a mom, as a mom who goes to bed every night with fear in her heart because I don't know how to protect my children. Is there any worse feeling as a parent?
Yeah, that's scary.
The only thing I think could be worse is not knowing how to put food on the table, which is another issue that we deal with in this country. But to go to bed at night and look at my kids and kiss them goodnight, and I get weepy just thinking about it. And then I knew that aspect of this conversation needed to be had, especially because Fred Gutenberg is such a warrior.
Right.
And I knew what the pain that was in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I started and I basically said exactly what I said to you. And then I turned it over to Fred as my fears realized in Fred Gutenberg. And then Ben Jackson was there to really lay down, you know, he's a veteran, so
right.
he knows about these weapons.
Exactly.
He knows the power. And so I walked away from it feeling really inspired. And mind you, I would never, it's very hard for me because Ted has gone back on what he said in that meeting. And by the way, if people want to relive that meeting with me,
yeah.
they can find the whole unedited meeting on my Sorry Not Sorry podcast.
And they should, because
it is very civil, and it
right.
and both sides said what they needed to say.
That was so much fun with actress Alyssa Milano. Thank her so much for coming on the podcast. Now, let's go next to a chat I had with the Mooch. Yeah, you know him, you love him. Well, maybe you don't. Anthony Scaramucci, the former White House Director of Communications for just 11 days. After all of that hanging with Donald Trump, we got into why he now has a hangover and his decision to not only break with the president, but to speak out against Trump more forcefully and directly. You came out of the box a couple of months ago in a very pronounced way. You made it very clear. You were like the guy who was part of the cult of personality for a while and realized, wait a minute, hold up. You kind of woke up and said, wait a minute. This is about my country. This is about how my government runs and the people who lead that government. How was that transformation for you completed? And how has it been since then? Have you been able, you think, to have people appreciate that change and the perspectives that you now bring, having been inside and recognized, wait a minute, this isn't right for the country?
Well, so let me say this. I think it puts you in a difficult position. I have a 27-year-old son who's in his second year at Stanford Business School. And a month ago, he's like, "Pops, you got everybody hating you. You got the Republicans hating you because you're disavowing Trump. You've got the liberals hating you because what took you so long, you know? And now you're stuck where now you got everybody hating you. I thought you went into politics to build up your network." You know, because I said that to my kid about, you know,
right.
25 years ago, I started writing checks. I had no network, Michael. I never was a member of a country club. I couldn't hit a golf ball or a tennis ball. I was like, okay, I'm a Republican. Maybe I can meet some people who can help me grow my business. You know, I mean, that's what I did. So because now you're in no man's land. You're in the Bermuda Triangle. And I laughed. I said, AJ, maybe I'm getting closer to the truth than if everybody dislikes me. Because maybe the truth is somewhere out there where the guy is nuts. The Republicans that know he's nuts, and you know a lot of these Republicans, Michael,
oh, yeah.
and they talk you off the record,
I know.
They tell you that he's nuts.
It's
okay,
annoying as hell.
And right, and then they won't admit it. I don't want to be one of those people. Okay, and then the flip side is, I tell my liberal friends, okay, you know what? I got here late. I'm a Republican. I'm a loyal guy. I'm a product of my upbringing. I grew up in a neighborhood. If I was supporting somebody, I'm not this kind of guy that just breaks off and disavows somebody. But over time, it was an evolutionary process. It was child separation, don't like it. Federal going after our intelligence, don't like it. Press is enemy of the people, sorry, I don't like it. And then when we finally got to the full-on Charlottesville, I denounced it. You can find me on videos and geez, you can't talk like that.
Right.
And then finally, after a year plus of this sort of aberrant activity, as a business person, I look at it and say, okay, we give this person a chance. This is aberrant, abnormal, unpresidential, ridiculous activity. The policies are not even that good. He's screwing up the entire trade situation. He's breaking down the global alliances. He's hurting our soft power. And a lot of regional conflicts are starting because he doesn't understand how to orchestrate our alliances. Okay, so here we are now, and I made a mistake, which I admit. I supported someone that I shouldn't have, and here we are now. But I'm telling my friends, you better create an off-ramp for other people, because there's going to be more people coming off of that Trump train. The wheels are off that train.
Right.
And that train's heading into a mountainside.
Well,
and there's a lot of people that have to come off that train. If you're going to ridicule them, if people decide to ridicule those people, and believe me, I've got a tough skin. I can take any ridicule. People can say whatever they want about me, but I'm just recommending to people, if you want to beat President Trump, and I think he is a clear and present danger to the United States, and he needs to be knocked out of office, you got to let those people off the train, and you got to let those people, into your camp. So that's one of the tensions that's gone on over the last 3 to 6, 7 weeks. Some of the people on the left are like unforgiving, and obviously some of the people on the right are like, I know you're right, but I have to disavow you publicly. I hope you're okay with it.
Yes,
yeah, I'm not really that okay with it, but go ahead, do what you
do. What you got to do. Well, you have a plan,
right,
to get former cabinet members to speak out. How is that coming together?
Yeah.
How does that come
working
together?
On that, yeah.
And how does that manifest itself in the space that we're just talking about, where people are afraid of their own shadow when it comes to Trump for some crazy ass reason?
I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised that there's many cabinet members that are now ready, former cabinet members that are now ready. And I think one of the issues is timing. Some of these people are really, in my conversations, are like, well, I want to maximize the timing of what I'm going to say to directly impact the situation. I think what I'm working on right now, a year ago, there was an anonymous letter in the New York Times, or a year and a month ago, something like that, about how incapable the president is and how crazy it is inside the White House. And people were critical of that letter, myself included, that nobody signed that letter. So I'm in the process right now of writing a version 2.0 of that letter. I've distilled and talked to many cabinet members, current administration officials, ex-administration officials, and I'm certainly going to be signing that letter. I'm hopeful that there'll be a few people that will sign that letter alongside of me. If they decide not to, I'm okay with it as well, but it'll be a very comprehensive evaluation of what is currently going on, and it'll be a Surgeon General's warning label for people who are actually still supporting this man, to recognize the decline in mental faculties, to recognize the lack of managerial capabilities, the lack of leadership qualities, to recognize the bellicosity of his bullying, how that is literally got people in a paralyzed state inside the government. So I'm gonna be writing that, or I will articulate it, and it's going to be a distillation of many different people that I've spoken to. And when I'm done writing it, and I've asked people of ex-cabinet members and current cabinet members to proofread it for me, and if they like it, hopefully they'll sign on.
Yeah.
But I do predict, even if nobody signs on, Michael, there'll be a very decent-sized group of people over the ensuing months, into the end of the year and into the beginning of next year, speaking out, because you really can't have this guy as your president for another 4 or 5 years.
The mooch may be on to something, folks. Can we afford another 4 years of Trump? Well, one of the people who has a sense of how the country and the media is processing exactly what this presidency has been about, almost more than anyone else, is April Ryan. A member of the White House press corps, she's the White House correspondent and the Washington bureau chief for American Urban Radio Networks. She's also a CNN political analyst and the author of Under Fire, Reporting from the Front Lines of the Trump White House. And we got into what it's like reporting from the belly of the beast. From your perspective, reporting from ground zero for crazy, how do you do it? How do you maintain? Because there were times I would watch you, April, and I'm screaming at the television.
Were you really?
I'm not screaming at you, screaming for you. I'm like, slap that bitch. I'm like,
what?
I'm like, what the hell? Don't take that shit from them. Push back, girl. Push back. So that's me.
Let me tell you something.
That's me.
Now that the podium is gone, trust me. That's all I'm gonna say. Trust me. She won't. She has no security blanket anymore. That podium is gone. And I just don't want. There's a picture.
But you
on
went
Instagram
through it though. Looking. But you went through. You received death threats. You had to have protection for
then.
Your family because of
I
your covering this administration.
I've had to move. I've got bodyguards. That is my life. But I'm going to tell you something, Michael Steele. From the people that I come from, we believe in resilience. And this is greater than me. It's not even about me. Dr. King, if it weren't for Dr. King, I wouldn't be there. If it wasn't for Harriet Tubman, I wouldn't be there. You tell that beautiful story about your mama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had family like that. You know, I stand on the shoulders of greatness. I stand on the shoulders of not just black people, but white people
mm-hmm.
who want to see a day when we are all free, when we all have equality, be it the pocketbook, when we don't have poverty, when we can all walk into places, when we don't have the interstates dividing us, keeping one group in and one group out. You know, when we all can get a good education.
Right.
It's bigger than me. I cannot quit. I cannot quit. And I'm not, the president can call me every name in the book, but guess what? I'm still keep coming.
Well,
I'm going to still keep coming because the issue
we know that.
Is,
we know that.
Yeah, you do.
Sister girl ain't going no. She don't back down, folks. Trust me.
They can post all the little Instagram things, talk about April Ryan's a liar. I'm lying about what? They call me names, but they don't stick because I am not what they call me. And my integrity, who I am, what I have asked, people know me and they don't even know me. So, you know, it's crazy, Michael. But they can keep on doing it. But the issues of the day, today, how do I keep going back? Because Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are having impeachment inquiry hearings.
Right.
Because everybody's talking quid pro quo. Mine is to help you understand what quid pro quo is. That Latin term that people are like, huh? It's over their head. Mine as a reporter is to tell you what they're talking about, quid pro quo, bribery, extortion, okay?
Right.
Crime. Okay, but mine is to tell you that all of this is a national security issue. Yeah, there are quid pro quos in government. You do for me and I do for you. But this was not about government to government. This was about government for a person, government to a person.
Right.
So it's different. So this,
well, yeah,
this
and
is why I'm here.
Now, that's a pretty powerful statement of purpose from a White House correspondent like April Ryan. At the opposite end of the political spectrum, of course, is former Congressman Joe Walsh. We will follow up with that right after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you.
All right, everybody, we're back. Former Congressman Joe Walsh, a controversial figure who's been accused of racist statements in the past. Now, on the twist, he's now running as a Republican for president against Donald Trump. Yep, he's in that Republican primary that no Republican seems to want to have. Of course, this conversation was not going to be about what's your favorite color, but rather what's the difference between being a racist and saying racist things. Your immediate reaction is, I'm not a racist, which would probably be the reaction of most people, that they're not a racist. But at some point, don't you sit there and go, well, shit, someone, they're saying this a lot for a reason.
No.
What is that reason? I mean, because people just aren't going to make that up, Joe. Then it's not going to call you that if you've not given them a reason to do that.
Well, but again, you
right?
Without, without context, like you brought up an example of one tweet.
Right.
And that's an interesting tweet about the Dallas cops. And I'm telling you, from my perspective, again, just mine, the guy
right.
who wrote the tweet, there's nothing racist that I intended in there. But when you're on national TV and John Heilman turns to you and says you're a racist, of course I'm going to say I'm not a racist because I don't believe I am.
But he said that based on a body of work, to put it in those terms. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
he did it based on past comments, tweets. I mean, Joe, it's not like two tweets or one conversation. I mean, you've got a body of work in this area, if you will, in which people draw from that impression. So my question to you, in trying to help understand, you know, again, for me, because I'm fascinated by the evolution, and I applaud that. No, seriously. I'm serious about that. I applaud that the lights have come on in a way for you that you now see, whether it's Trump or whatever, that you now see that these things have an effect. But my question is, when
deal.
People say that back in the day, aside from just
disclaiming as I'm not a racist, at what point did it kick in that, well, maybe there's a reason why they're saying that?
Yes, because as you said, they look at my body of work.
Right.
Now, again, Michael, I don't think I'm defined by that body of work.
Well, you're
not. If you went through my 66,000 tweets, 99% of them are all like about policy.
Right.
But that's fair. Maybe there are 40 or 50
tweets. Yeah, but
tweets.
You know, all it takes is one fly in the punch bowl, baby. and people stop drinking.
No, Michael, absolutely. So all I can do is say, here's what I meant, okay, and apologize if I need to apologize.
Right.
I will say it predates Trump. After 2 to 3 years on talk radio, I got tired. I mean, part of what I was trying to do is be provocative and get people to think. See, I think the difference between me and Trump is he just throws racist shit out there because he just wants to benefit
right.
anything that will
benefit
from
him. Right.
Yeah, I throw stuff out there. I think my intentions were different. I wanted people to think. I wanted to push the boundaries on certain issues. And oftentimes, I went over the line. What I learned in the year or two before Trump, and I'm still not perfect on it, is, as you just said a few minutes ago, look at it from somebody else's shoes, which is why I've tried to do things like hold town halls in front of black audiences and start this podcast with a black radio host. So that I can more easily understand the things I've said, how they're viewed in other people's eyes.
So if you're asking for forgiveness, which you have done, and I think, and I have to tell you, in listening to your conversation on Nicole's show, I felt that, and I think Nicole felt it too. So if you're asking for forgiveness, from whom are you asking that forgiveness?
Michael, that's a great question. That's a really, really good question, because it goes to a bigger thing. Part of what I think my behavior helped lead to was Trump. If there's like one thing I feel the most guilty about, it's that. And I wasn't the only one at the parade, but I was certainly at the parade where I spewed offensive, hateful stuff too often.
Right.
And I think that helped lead to Trump. But here I am running against him, Michael. And I mean, look, let's be clear about something. And I love what you're doing because this is a great conversation and you should pick my ass apart on these tweets. I mean that. But we're talking about me
right.
and probably 60 stupid tweets against a guy in the White House who lies every time he opens his mouth, who welcomed and encouraged Russian interference, who still would take foreign dirt on an opponent. I mean, you're talking about a guy right now who's like off the charts unfit to be president, and here I am getting raked over the coal on some tweets. I've got to make the case to the average Republican voter out there, not just that he's bad, but I'm different. I'm apologizing, genuinely. And some people, Michael, may never believe it,
sure.
But ideally, I can go to voters with that and say, I've learned. I contributed to this shit we've got in the White House.
You know, folks, I really appreciate it then and still do now the fact that former Congressman Joe Walsh would come on the podcast and have that conversation. Now, continuing our look back at some of the best moments from the Michael Steele podcast in 2019, we now get to spend a little time with Ben Howe. Yep, the author of The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. Now, if you've listened to this podcast, you know I don't suffer hypocrites, especially of the Christian variety. So Ben and I got into, you know, have evangelical Christians made a devil's bargain in order to elect and now even re-elect Donald Trump? And why the hell do they view Trump as the next King David? I don't even get it. What were rank and file evangelical Christians saying? What do they say when they hear a Franklin Graham, for example, make the kind of defense and offhanded, well, I never said he was the ideal Christian, you
mm-hmm.
know.
I think people, everyone, not just Christians, and really Americans, culturally speaking, we love underdogs. We love redemption arcs.
You're right.
You know, brokenness speaks to us. It's often the case that a compelling narrative involves somebody who has failed.
Right.
And these are all great stories that also litter the Bible. But you can't just take any story that you need to fit and pretend that's what it is. There is no redemptive arc. He hasn't apologized for anything that he's done. And in fact, when asked if he even said, asked for forgiveness from God himself, he said no.
Right.
When he discusses some of the foundational aspects of what it means to deal with your brokenness or to seek redemption, he shows a much more importantly than whether or not he knows it's 2 Corinthians versus 2 Corinthians,
right,
is whether or not he understands that Jesus died for our sins, and part of that is seeking redemption and forgiveness. And, you know, one of the things that I didn't focus on in the book, but it does gall me at times when I hear things like that from Franklin Graham, and I think about these guys that are surrounding him on this evangelical board. Who's looking out for Donald Trump's soul? You know, these guys are they're whispering in his ear, hey, you know, sin and redemption, all that, you don't have to worry about that. Like, you're protecting us, therefore we will protect you. Don't worry about all that stuff. I mean, they are literally not looking out. Donald Trump's loved by God just like everyone else.
All right.
So who here on earth that is right in his ear speaking on behalf of God is looking out for this man's soul? I don't think anyone is.
Yeah, because it's not politically expedient to do so. It is, I surmise, very transactional between these folks. And you put it very well. You know, you cover us on the things that are important to us, and we'll give you cover when people come after you, by the way, for the way you lived your life.
Right.
And the way you behave.
And all we're asking in return is that you protect our stuff.
Right.
Is basically what it is. Protect our borders, our stuff, our land, which, you know, I am not open borders by any stretch of the imagination, although I'm sure that you have also been accused of the same, because anything other than towing the line for Donald Trump means you literally want anarchy at the border.
Right.
You know, even aside from that, where did Jesus go when he came? People were expecting, who were waiting on the Messiah back then, people were expecting this, you know, powerful, strong,
militant,
band on a steed to go right into the Capitol and deal with the Caesar, you know?
Right.
That's not what he came in on a donkey and got killed.
Right.
You know, and to now describe what we're looking for as the very thing that we were shown in the Bible is not what we should be looking for. Like my dad likes to say, it literally says to approach the questions of spirituality and relationship with God with meekness and trembling. I mean, you are supposed to speak to people in a way that invites them in, that doesn't push them away. And that's why merging it with partisanship is so dangerous, because that's not how partisan politics work. It's a bloodbath.
Why the emphasis on that opens up an interesting door, because it, when you look at it from the, you know, you're right, it is a bloodbath. Partisan politics is very much a bloodbath, and it's one of those things that eats away at the very soul of the individual. It can, because you're oftentimes put in positions to make decisions that would not necessarily be upheld as the Christian thing to do.
Right, in the effort to support the team.
Right. So you've always, at least in my upbringing, you always had moral leadership that would be there to say, this way, this is the standard. This is
refocus you.
Right, right. So now when those leaders themselves have been corrupted to the point where, I think, as you put it in the book, they begin to prioritize power over persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
What impact does that have for the evangelical church in terms of people who the next generation, if you will, who may be drawn or not drawn to the pews of these evangelical leaders?
Well, you know, one of the things that is interesting about the future of evangelicalism is there is reason for hope in a lot of ways. In one way is that there is a growing minority population that are starting to become evangelicals, and they're rejecting a lot of what this version of evangelicalism is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And these demographic shifts are assisting in a way, not to bring progressivism into the church, which is what a lot of people on the right assume that means. It's a lot of people saying, look, I believe in the Bible literalism, and I believe in being born again, but I reject this notion that in order to be a good Christian, I have to pull the lever for a particular political party. And I think that there's hope in the sense that there's more people that are identifying as an evangelical while refusing to take up the banner of what is currently about 81% of them, the ones we're talking about here. I try to remind people sometimes, 81%, yes, but 19%
so,
did not. And I'm hoping that that grows. And it grows with voices like Russell Moore and Beth Moore. It grows with voices like yours. It grows with, I mean, I know you're not an evangelical, but I'm saying it grows with more and more people rejecting this religious fusion with partisan politics and saying, if we're going to be Christians first, we need to be Christians first and not merge it with something that has short-term goals like winning the next election or getting a Supreme Court nominee.
Now, next is a surprising and fascinating conversation with, of all people, Marianne Williamson, Democratic presidential candidate, author, and motivational speaker. Now, this was one of the more refreshing conversations because we actually spent less time dissecting our nation's politics and delving into the underlying spirituality of it all instead. What struck me about you, and I think it may have been either the second debate, I think it was the second debate, where you started to say some things that people at first were kind of, you know, to be honest, they kind of laughed at, you know? And when you started, you talked about policy almost from a spiritual standpoint, where you connected in a way the human nature of it. This is not just about black letter law or words on paper or pushing through some policy machine, an idea that spits out on the other end regulations that will then control how much money your state gets or how much health care you can afford. But you try to frame that policy from a humanistic perspective. In short, hey, there are people on the other end of this. How? And that struck me as a former seminarian and as a former lieutenant governor who brought that sort of approach to a number of the policies that I advocated for when I was in office. That struck a nerve with me. And I think it struck a nerve with a lot of people out there. What's your assessment of that hunger right now in America for that level of raising spirituality? And I don't mean this in the, traditional church, religious sense. I'm talking about just recognizing the humanity of individuals and how policy has an impact on that.
I think people might want to read the Declaration of Independence again.
Good point. Good point.
Declaration of Independence is not just some dry,
right,
technocratic, rationalistic document. It's not just a political document. It is a document that lays claim to an earth-shatteringly different relationship between human beings and their government and the possibilities for their lives. It's a philosophical document as much as it is a political document. And all of the juiciness of that has been lost in our current age and to our detriment. But it is an aberration. That's what's important that we remember. It is an aberration that we have made politics so dry, that we've made it so rationalistic, that we have removed it as much as we have
from
the deeper waters of human emotion and psychology. That's the aberration.
I agree with you. It's easier to manage it that way. I can, from a party standpoint,
and to control it.
Exactly. Yeah, from a process. Purely straight up, how much money comes in, how much money goes out, who's up, who's down, I can control that because if I exercise away from the game, that humanistic piece that you're talking about, that spirituality, that sort of underpinning and understanding of who we are relative to all other things, I dumb it down to that point. Hey, you know, I got way more control than I would otherwise because, and I think that was one of the things that the founders were so concerned about introducing this sort of, how do I want to phrase it? This sort of unfeeling sort of infrastructure, institutional, political body, you know, known as political parties. They wanted to keep it a little bit more fluid, recognizing the humanity of individuals, which you're right. Our founding documents are replete with that attitude.
Well, there are a couple of things about that. First of all, in the Jewish religion, it is said that every generation has to rediscover God for itself. And John Adams said that he hoped that every July 4th, Americans would revisit our first principles. And what has happened in our country is that we are too many generations away now from a time when people really psychologically and emotionally bonded adequately with the principles of the Declaration of Independence, which are not left or right, but they are deeply democratic, and they lay claim to a vision of God-given rights. Let's not forget that. God gave inalienable rights of life and of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Now, when you were saying a couple of minutes ago, and I agreed with you, it makes people easier to control when they are not bonded with those principles. Because when you're not bonded with those principles, which are essentially America's mission statement, you become easier to play. So when you have 13 million children who are hungry in this country, 100,000 children, and these are, for the most part, they're citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm. So 13 million of them are hungry. 100,000 of them are homeless. We have millions of American children who go to school every day in classrooms that don't even have the adequate school supplies with which to teach a child to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 8, then the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased. The chances of incarceration are drastically increased. Where is that child's right to pursue happiness? And it says in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted to secure those rights, and that if government is not doing its job, it's the right of the people to alter it or to abolish it. That's juicy stuff, Michael. The stuff of, man, if you're convicted around that, if the American people, just that alone, were bonded adequately and emotionally to those principles generation after generation, there is so much that now literally tyrannizes the American people that could never have gotten this bad because people would have cast it out years ago.
And finally, from perhaps the wildest, most rollicking, back and forth, too woke to win, the politics of black women and the victimhood of white men episode was with none other than Tiffany Cross, co-founder and managing editor of The Beat DC, a national platform intersecting politics, policy, and people of color. And, well, we pretty much ran through every intersection, folks. I like Joe Biden. Now, just on the record, I've been on the record about liking Joe Biden for a long time. I think he is, of all the candidates, by far the strongest positioned to take on Trump and win. Now, am I the only one who thinks that? No, Chris Christie actually said it as well. And others are a lot of Republicans, whether they say it privately or publicly, feel the same way when they look at him. Why? For a number of reasons, Tiffany. We've watched him. We've known him. Some of us have grown up with him, etc. But I thought he came out of the box strong. What was your initial take, and how do you think he's being received or will be received?
So I think Joe Biden.
It slip starts already.
It's a Freudian slip. But that's kind of the point I'm making. I think that Joe Biden definitely satisfies some Obama nostalgia for some people in the electorate, right, for sure. I do think there's another fractured portion in the Democratic electorate who may be a little more woke than they are nostalgic. And, you know, this is his time at the top of the ticket. And this is where, you know, it's one thing to love Uncle Joe and, you know, see him and be excited about him. It's another to have to defend a long legislative record that a lot of people are young and they don't remember
really?
What was happening at that time.
You're gonna have that fight. So you mean to tell me people are gonna project? We are so bad at projecting back.
our current attitudes on issues 30 years and expecting people to have been enlightened enough to figure out time and place didn't matter, that you should have been enlightened enough. Do you know how many Democrats supported his position, his vote on the crime bill?
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. But
so why should he have to relitigate that?
Because that's, you have to make your case to the American people. And I think that
American
there are
people don't care
young,
about that.
I beg to differ. Absolutely. The American people do. But
Find me the poll that says the American people care about Joe Biden's position on the crime bill in 1986.
Well, I'll tell you why I can't find you the poll, because a lot of young people don't have landlines, and a lot of the polls are specifically focused on New Hampshire and Iowa that don't reflect the changing demographics of the country. But some of these younger people, Michael, I will tell you,
right,
they don't have the benefit of time and days spent on this earth. So they are going to judge this candidate by 2019 standards for things that he did in 1989.
How would they judge Barack Obama and his position on gay marriage?
I think harshly, and we have to remind, that's why it's a candidate's prerogative and priority, I would even say, to make their case, because Joe Biden came out, he got ahead of the White House on this. He came out before Obama did for gay marriage. So I think this is a challenge for candidates. It's a challenge for voters to adjust. And, you know, look, any of these candidates, any of these 137 candidates running for president are light years ahead of the current situation. You know, we are in dire straits here. So by no means am I saying that this is something that we should judge against Trump. But remember, Michael, they're not running against Donald Trump. They're running against each other.
Yeah,
and when you have a Joe Biden out there to make his case, these things, like it or not, fair or
not, sure,
are going to come up. And he's going to have a story to tell about it.
Not my battle. My primary is all messed up. But, you know, yeah, you can be woke all day long, but you need to win at night. And so the problem is, don't let your wokeness get in the way of winning. And you've got to assess how you go about that. I'm not saying that, you know, that it was all, you know, candy and lollipops on these issues. I've seen, having served statewide as a statewide official, the impact of those policies on cities like Baltimore or counties like Prince George's County and even my hometown of D.C., and the direct impact it's had on the black community. But the steps that have been taken since then and the position, I'm more interested. So, okay, that was an issue. Have you evolved? What's your thinking now in light of the no longer just anecdotal, but real-life experience of people having to deal with those policies, et cetera, and see what he says. My sense, though, and the reason I raised it, Tiffany, is that I just get the sense from some progressives that they want to use it as a cudgel to beat this man down. And I'm like, okay, you can do that, but I just don't know if that's really how you want to go about your primary. I mean, see what he's going to do on the issues that the majority of the country will be with that Democratic candidate on. To win against Trump in November.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. You know, I'm just offering my analysis. I'm not.
No, I'm just doing a little devil's advocate.
But
go ahead.
I want to say that because no matter, you know how this game goes. No matter what you say, the Twitters will attack you for being you're in so and so's pocket. You're in so and so's pocket. So I want to say to people, I'm not endorsing any candidate. I just offer my analysis on this. And I agree with what you're saying, Michael. But I think, you know, when people look at this field of candidates, there are some people who have some of those Joe Biden type qualities without the baggage.
Who?
And there, I think Elizabeth Warren, for one.
Warren is not going to win an election against Donald Trump. put that on the table and accept it for what it is. Tell me where she wins. What part of the middle of this country does Elizabeth Warren win? She's not winning Pennsylvania, and she's certainly not going to win Wisconsin.
I think the old playbook, though, honestly, in a post-Trump America has been ruled out. Because I remember in 2016 and 2015 saying a reality TV star is not going to win the presidency of the United States. So,
And the voters said a lot about that, too. And those of us who were afraid, you know, trying to figure out how to overcome that blue wall, he did. So how does she overcome the red wall?
but that's the difference. I think it's an error and for Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or any or Pete Buttigieg, any of these candidates. I think it is an error for them to try to overcome the red wall.
Okay. I
don't understand this tactic that Democrats have of going after and targeting these Trump supporters. You didn't see
because they vote.
They vote, but they are a problem. You don't see scores of Republicans going out here trying to target Obama voters. So why I would ask
because
Democrats
vote, because Obama voters aren't going to vote for Donald Trump, but Donald
That's
Trump,
right.
but a Bernie Sanders voter will vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, I think
we all know that Bernie Sanders voter who voted for Donald Trump. I met five of them during the Democratic National Convention.
And I would say that voter is problematic. And when you look at that voter compared to the changing demographics of what the Democratic electorate looks like,
right.
Why not go after the people who've been riding with you for a long time, who are your ride or die supporters? Listen, in 2020, Latino voters...
Because you ain't got enough of them. That's why.
That's not true. Look, everybody listening, do not believe the hype Michael Steele is trying to put out here today. That is not true. And let me tell you why. So in 2020,
you ain't got enough of them.
That's not. Who told you that lie? You've been watching Fox News too much. That's just not true. That is not true. Let me tell you. The first
okay.
thought, Asian American
yes.
voters
uh-huh.
are the fastest growing demographic. And uh-huh. I believe something like 80% don't identify with a political party. This
right.
is a demographic that's up for grabs.
Sure.
In 2018,
sure.
they were the key deciding votes in a lot of districts.
That's
in
fun.
2020, Latino voters are going to eclipse everybody. They're going to be the largest block of eligible voters. That doesn't mean registered voters,
right.
but of eligible voters.
Well, I only live in a land of registered voters. I can't deal with eligible voters because eligible voters don't mean anything to me. What matters to me are registered voters. The people who are registered
all the time
to show their ass up at a poll. That's who, as a party guy, that's who I'm targeting. I'm not targeting the guy who I think I want to register. I may register. Oh, I'll get to that tomorrow. I'm talking about the people, young and old, doesn't matter, who are actually registered. Phew. Well, see what I mean? Mm-hmm. An amazing, enlightening, and fun conversation with Tiffany Cross. I really appreciated that one. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. The first of 2020. It's in the bank. Yep, we're done. Yep, 2019 was a wild ride, and 2020 is only going to get wilder, folks, as we head into the presidential election and now a possible war with Iran. Wait, what? 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 Where did that come from? Well, yeah, we'll get into that next week. And as 2020 gets underway, I hope you stick with the Michael Steele podcast for some interesting and not so conventional perspectives on everything from politics to the economy to social media to entertainment. We want to bring it all to you and have something to say about it. Remember, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Thanks, folks, for all of the downloads. We really appreciate it. And have a happy, prosperous, and blessed new year.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.